It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 2021, Carnegie Mellon University will send the first American robotic rover of its kind to the moon. The unmanned rover will carry a camera, tools to analyze moon rocks and soil, and the first museum on the moon. Also known as MoonArk, the museum is filled with hundreds of images, poems, music, and artifacts from Earth. But it's not the first time that art has been sent to outer space. With us today is Lowry Burgess, Professor Emeritus of Art, former Dean of the College of Fine Arts at Carnegie Mellon University. He's a pioneer of the space art movement and one of the founding members of the MoonArk team. Lowry, welcome to the Confluence. Good to talk with you today.
Good to talk with you also.
Let's start with an easy one. So, what is space art?
Space art is the idea of the extension of humanity into space. And the fact is that, you know, when humans go into space, we bring our whole culture with us. It's not just science, technology, but it's all of our feelings, all of our aspirations and hopes, which go out there also. And the fact that space is not just an empty thing out there, it's longing for life and longing for our love, and we are loving it.
So not necessarily our impressions of space, but our impressions of ourselves?
Yes. No, it's so much about the totality of humanity and what we are and can be, both what we can be on Earth, which I hope is going to be a lot better, but in outer space, where we can seek a future.
Your art was the first official non-scientific payload flown into outer space on Space Shuttle Discovery. What can you tell us about that first piece?
Well, the first piece was called the Boundless Cubic Lunar Aperture, and it was about the notion that the moon is a destination that is easily understood by everybody, and that the moon is a gateway for the Earth into more cosmic consciousness. And it was an extremely complex work that NASA chose because it was the only work after, you know, about 200 applications. It was the only work that really required being in outer space for it to be achieved. And so it went up and was on the shuttle and floated in zero gravity, and some other wonderful stories about, you know, it was accompanied by UFOs documented and admitted to by NASA. The spaceship was accompanied for almost 2 days, and I got teased horribly by NASA in Houston. You know, it was you who, you know, they could figure out all our technology, but they couldn't figure out your artwork. So
that first piece, Boundless Cubic Lunar Aperture, that came back to Earth, obviously. MoonArk will not. So why keep it up there?
Well, we've done for 10 years, and I have a magnificent team of people, Mark Baskner and Dylan Vitone and Matt Zwicka, who are my core team. And we have, with, 12 other collaborators and, you know, two other universities and, you know, 300 collaborators, we've made this thing, which is all the arts now. We're not taking anything old up there. It's all new created stuff, new technologies, new sciences, new everything. And the idea is that we're sending the best of what we can produce on Earth now into space. And here, is something that we have basically created to last for a billion or a billion, billion years on the moon, which it can.
It's all new. So explain the collection. Give us an idea of some samples of the collection.
Oh, the collection consists of, samples from the Earth, okay, from different geological layers, very old, billions of years old stuff. And then it's good collections of, human things like animal stuff, like hummingbirds and on and on and on. So it's the first chamber. There are four chambers. So the first chamber is the Earth chamber, which has all of these things in it. The second chamber is the metaspheric chamber, which is the chamber that contains all the stuff that is between the Earth and the Moon, all our satellite stuff. The third chamber is the Moon chamber, which is the museum itself that contains all of the elements of the museum and all the arts. And then the fourth chamber is the etheric chamber. So it's all organized around very positive, hopeful things. There's nothing there that, so we're all about a symbiosis and hope and the fact that, if we communicate better and if we collaborate better, we can make a better world.
Four chambers. What size are we talking about?
Oh, they're about 2 inches in diameter and 2 inches tall. So the whole object is 8 inches tall, 2 inches in diameter. And there are two of them, one made to stay on Earth, to be seen here on Earth, and one to be, to be on the moon.
Okay, 50 years since the moon landing. Why it's important that we send art into space?
Because, art making is what we as a species do. It's unique. Tigers don't make art. No other creature makes art to see itself. So if we don't send art in space, we're not sending our species into space.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Lowry Burgess, CMU Professor Emeritus of Art, one of the founding members of the MoonArc team. MoonArc is a highly collaborative, integrated project that will send art to the moon in either late 2020 or early 2021. So MoonArc is a decade-long project, hundreds of people across almost every discipline involved, but not everything can make it. How did you decide what made the final cut?
I think, the quality of the work, the fact that it addressed a hope for the future. I think it was the fact that everything would have to be part of a extended narrative, if you want, a coherent narrative.
You had to deal with size limitations, weight limitations. How did you overcome the constraints?
Well, the first thing I was confronted with was, it costs $1 million a pound.
Oh.
to send something into space. Well, guess what? There's no art budget that I've seen anywhere that has $1 million. So the first thing I had to think was, oh my God, either the things have to be weightless or electronic. And then that led to the whole search for micro, weightless stuff. And that's where we got to, and that's what we reacted to, and there we are.
So how do you try and capture the essence of humanity in an 8-ounce work of art?
Well, we worked really hard to do that, and now the story is out, and people are agreeing that we're sending something to the moon that represents the best of us and not the worst, and that's what I'm hoping.
Did any new tech come out of the project?
Oh, absolutely. New materials technology, new new science. Everybody loved it, because this, what's really critical for everybody here is the arts can drive new science, new technology, new materials, new cognitive science, new everything. So that's what we did. And everybody said, oh, this is great. It's going to make us have to do new things. We are going to have to invent new crap. You know, we're going to new good stuff. So we had, for example, the discs in our new synthetic sapphire. So the sapphire clear discs that are so beautiful. And then they're coated with platinum. And then nothing's been done like that before. The platinum is then etched with image at the highest level of, resolution you can imagine.
What do you see as the future application of space art, whether it's 10, 50, 100 years from now?
Well, it's just the moving of human feeling, our feelings, into space, I think. It's the aesthetic. You know, aesthetics is a study of human feeling. And it's the fact that, you know, it's not, if we are really complex creatures filled with feelings. And if we don't move those feelings with us, it will be a very incomplete and I think not effective long reach. When we look at night, you look up in the sky at night, and you see, you know, and you think, oh, my goodness. Me in that. You're on Earth, and you're looking at, you know, the stars, and, you know, me in that. And that is an overwhelming experience.
Lowry Burgess is a professor emeritus of art at Carnegie Mellon University, pioneer of the space art movement, founding member of the MoonArk team, which launches its collection in 2021. Lowry, thanks so much for talking with us today.
So good to talk with you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, the next phase of Pennsylvania's Clean Slate law goes into effect tomorrow. It aims to help residents with minor criminal records find jobs and housing. Then, McGee Women's researchers are developing a more effective treatment for women suffering from pelvic prolapse. Coming up, hear from a gynecologist and a bioengineer about what this could mean for the lives of patients. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
Whitney Houston had a real problem on her hands in 1987. Her debut album, released just 2 years prior, included 3 chart-topping singles. How do you follow that up? And the answer was to sift through the previous goldmine once again. That meant tapping married couple George Merrill and Shannon Rubicam, who penned one of Houston's previous number ones. The pair, who recorded under the name Boy Meets Girl, wanted to keep the song I Want to Dance with Somebody Who Loves Me for themselves, though legend states that label head Clive Davis made it very clear that the song would in fact be Whitney's. It became her 4th number one on this day in 1987. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
Paddling for miles along historic rivers in Pennsylvania gets you up close and personal with nature and our industrial past. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. The Stony Kiski Conemaugh River's Sojourn is an annual event that features a colorful parade of kayaks and canoes. The 4-day, 44-mile journey is sponsored by the Conemaugh Valley Conservancy to inspire appreciation for local rivers, especially this network of waterways east of Pittsburgh. The group camps each night along the way from Johnstown to Apollo, and Andy Cubis joined the Sojourners on their last day on the water.
Today we are traveling from Avonmore to Roaring Run, 7 miles. There are some shallow ripples, occasional standing waves.
My name is Brooke Handley, and I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, and this is my first sojourn ever. It's even more than what I expected. I told everybody I kind of feel like I've been at summer camp for the past 4 days, which is awesome.
You ready?
Yep.
Okay, here you go.
Go. Ooh, that's cold. First day I dumped out, which is okay. Every other day, knock on wood, I haven't dumped out, so I'm learning as I'm going how to navigate things, and I've gotten a lot of great advice from all of the veteran paddlers.
I'm Amanda Wareham. I am from the Pittsburgh area. I have the orange, green, yellow kayak, and they said, I'll just call it a Skittle. And when I bought it, I said, oh, it kind of looks like a lifesaver. So most of us lead our lives and never really think about the rivers, but the river's such a big part of the ecosystem. And part of what we've done each evening is to have some educational sessions. And they've talked about in the last 30 years, really how the river life has been revitalized because, you know, primarily mining is what has really knocked out. And you can still see signs of it. There are some areas where you can come down and you can see the runoff where you can tell that it's iron ore and things like that.
Looks like rapids.
My name's Laura Hawkins. I am what's called a Greenway Coordinator for something called the Pittsburgh to Harrisburg Mainline Canal Greenway. This Kiskeaconomaw River system is sort of infamous. This is the path of the Johnstown flood. The Kiske River is the largest tributary into the Allegheny River. So what happens up here affects everything downstream and all of the Pittsburgh rivers.
My name is Mark Shank. I'm from Blairsville. And first time I ever come down the river, the Conemaugh River through the Pack Saddle Gap. I was 16 years old and the water was pure orange. So if you had anything white on, your parents knew where you were. And it's so nice now that the river's cleaned up. We got fish in it and wonderful recreation. You're taking some of the water home as a souvenir.
Yes, sir.
As you heard, acid mine drainage, or AMD, has plagued the Kiskeaconomaw watershed and many places in western Pennsylvania for decades. These discharges of iron and other metals seep from old coal mines and turn streams and rivers orange. No fish or anything else can live in them. Miles of these waterways have already been cleaned up, but there's more to do, especially on the Little Conemaugh River. It's estimated that 90% of it is impacted by AMD. I talked by phone with Brandon Deal, grants and project consultant at the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, about a $21 million project to clean up the river, a tributary of the Conemaugh. The project will connect three underground mines underground and construct a treatment plant.
There would be a mechanical process where alkaline material would be added to the water that comes out of these discharges. It would be aerated, chemically stirred, the iron and heavy metals would fall out of that sludge material, would go back into the mine pools, and we would discharge clean water.
Deal says the plant could be up and running by 2025 and bring back 12 miles of dead stream. The Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds has supported the Allegheny Front. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 40 million criminal charges in Pennsylvania will be eligible for automatic sealing beginning tomorrow. It's the next phase of a new state law passed to make it easier for some residents with criminal records to get jobs and housing. WHYY's Aaron Moselle explains how this one-of-a-kind process will work.
Pennsylvania's new Clean Slate Law applies to people with three kinds of criminal records. One is if you were arrested and charged but never convicted of a crime. The next is nonviolent misdemeanor convictions, charges like shoplifting and prostitution. The third category is summary offenses, like harassment and disorderly conduct. When Clean Slate took effect in December, residents with these kinds of records needed to hire a lawyer to get them sealed.
You'd prepare a petition, file it, you'd wait for a court date, a DA would have to look at it, a judge would have to look at it. If the petition was granted, then a clerk would have to enter information, and on and on.
Sharon Dietrich is a lead attorney at Community Legal Services, the nonprofit that helped craft the law. She says that process changes tomorrow.
It is the first day in the history of the United States that records will be sealed by automation. And it is quite possible that that first week, more cases will be sealed by automation than have ever been sealed in the entire history of the United States.
That's because automatic sealing is faster. Dietrich says that means eligible residents can get a second chance sooner, whether it's applying for the better paying job they couldn't get before or the apartment they couldn't rent.
Once this is done, I just feel like a weight will be lifted off my shoulders.
Nicole lives in West Philly. We've agreed to withhold her last name to protect her privacy. Her record consists of a string of arrests so old she can't remember most of the details. She knows one of them was for shoplifting about 15 years ago. Nicole had just lost her job to downsizing and she didn't have money for food.
I walked into a Wawa because I was hungry and I started eating.
She spent a couple nights in jail. The case was later dismissed due to a lack of evidence, but the arrest remained on her record, just like the other ones she racked up over the next 2 years. Her record meant she couldn't fulfill her dream of becoming a detective with the Philadelphia Police Department. That hurt, but she says the real punch was to her self-esteem. She felt like a second-class citizen, even though she was never convicted of a crime.
Even though we don't have caste and like social classes, we really do. So I think that knowing that my background will be sealed and like the record closed and a clean slate is just like looking through a lens and it's like going to become clear, you know?
Nicole will be one of the first Pennsylvania residents to have their criminal records automatically sealed. Others, like Ralph, have already felt the impact of the law. We're also withholding his last name so we don't foil his effort to put his criminal past behind him. Ralph got a pair of misdemeanor convictions sealed earlier this year, before automation kicked in. They're tied to a fight he had with an ex-girlfriend back in 2001. Ralph says his ex wasn't taking the medication she was prescribed for bipolar disorder.
It sort of was like living with Jekyll and Hyde. You didn't know what you was going to walk into.
He says his ex grabbed a bread knife and barricaded the door so he couldn't leave. She called the cops after the knife nicked her arm while he was moving her out of the way. Ralph served 2 years probation after pleading guilty to simple assault, possession of an instrument of crime, and making terroristic threats. He says his record stopped him from getting jobs he knew he was qualified for.
10, 15 minutes dictated about 10 or 15 years. Really honestly, about 16, 17 years.
In March, a life-changing letter from Ralph's lawyer arrived in the mail. Two of the three misdemeanor charges were officially sealed. The third one, making terroristic threats, didn't qualify for sealing under clean slate. Ralph was still ecstatic.
I was so happy. I told my fiance, I said, come on, get up, we're going to dinner. We're going to dinner.
3 months later, Ralph already has a better job as a supervisor at a manufacturing plant, making double what he used to. That pay bump meant he could finally afford to take a vacation, something he says he hadn't done for more than a decade. I'm Aaron Moselle in Philadelphia.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Researchers at McGee Women's Research Institute and the Swanson School of Engineering at the University of Pittsburgh are partnering to address a problem affecting many women, particularly mothers and grandmothers. They're trying to develop a more effective mesh to be used in pelvic surgical repair. Dr. Pamela Moali is the professor of obstetrics and gynecology. It's a division of reconstructive pelvic surgery at UPMC McGee Women's Hospital and McGee Women's Research Institute. And Dr. Steve Abramowicz is an associate professor of bioengineering at the University of Pittsburgh's Swanson School of Engineering. Thanks so much to both of you for coming in.
Well, thank you.
So, doctors, we'll start from the beginning. What is pelvic prolapse?
Pelvic organ prolapse refers to a common condition in women in which the pelvic organs descend out of their normal position in the pelvis, and that generally means they're falling into the vagina. This is known in layman's term as I have a dropped bladder or a dropped uterus.
How does this affect someone's life?
It really profoundly affects women's lives. It interferes with a lot of times their ability to empty their bladder. It can interfere with their personal life in terms of sexual activity. It can, they may be afraid they're going to leak urine as a result of it. So it can lead to social isolation. So there's a lot of psychosocial consequences, as well as a bother, a feeling of pressure, this thing, abnormal sensation that can really decrease their quality of life.
So who exactly does it affect? How many women? How widespread is this?
Roughly a third of all women will have some sort of pelvic floor disorder, that is urinary incontinence, pelvic organ prolapse, or fecal incontinence. 12.6% of women will undergo a surgical repair of pelvic organ prolapse in their lifetime. So it just depends on how you define it, but it's fairly common.
So what is the current procedure like, the current standard?
There's multiple procedures that we tailor to a woman's condition and her needs. So typically, when a woman has prolapse, it's not just one organ that's coming down. It's typically the uterus, the bladder, and sometimes also the small bowel and rectum. So there's different ways we can approach it. It can include having a hysterectomy or not having a hysterectomy. It can include using their own tissues, or in some cases it can involve augmenting the repair using a biomaterial such as mesh.
And so that biomaterial brings us to your work, Dr. Abramowitch. How did you get involved in this research and development of a new product?
Well, the research is dating back to, I think, about 2004. I was actually finishing my PhD in Savio Wu's laboratory, which is called the Musculoskeletal Research Center. We focused primarily on orthopedics then. And Dr. Morali actually approached us and said, you know, this is a mechanical problem, and we really need to study it from a mechanical perspective. And there's really only one other group that's doing that. And so she approached my advisor at the time and said, you know, would you guys be willing to participate in an investigation in this? And fortunately, I was kind of finishing my PhD, and he allowed me to do that. We wrote a grant, and we got the funding for that. And so that allowed me to continue to do this research. And in doing that, I realized that there's a, you know, it's a really significant problem for a lot of women. I was focused a lot on ACL injuries, mm-hmm. Which also are kind of a quality of life issue. But, you know, when I realized that there's this kind of hidden problem, so to speak, that's affecting the lives of all these women, it made me kind of reconsider, you know, do I really want to focus my career on ACL injuries? Because that's been pretty well treated to a large degree. And from what I started to learn about pelvic organ prolapse, the treatments, while there are effective treatments out there, there's still a lot that we have to do and a lot we need to know.
So the research began in 2004. That's 15 years ago. What have you learned? What new solutions are on the horizon?
Well, you know, one of the things that we're particularly excited about is a new grant that we just got from the NIH, where we are taking basically what we've learned over the past 15 years about mesh and trying to modify it to improve outcomes for women. So we're actually looking at a new materials. One of the things we're looking at are elastomeric materials, which behave much more like native tissue. And we feel like that will provide better integration of the tissue into the device that we're going to be manufacturing.
One of the current devices is made out of strong, flexible plastic, polypropylene. Is that correct?
Polypropylene, yeah.
How would these new solutions maybe compare to how that behaves in the body?
So from a material perspective, polypropylene is a very kind of stiff material. So if you want to imagine, polypropylene is very similar to Tupperware. And in fact, much of Tupperware is polypropylene. Now what they do to manufacture the mesh is they take the plastic and they basically extrude it down into what we call small filaments. And then those small filaments are knitted together to form a mesh, which is actually quite compliant. And so what we're interested in doing is actually just taking that material and making a much softer version of that material. So instead of using polypropylene, we're going to be using another type of elastomeric material. It has the ability to stretch and recoil, but it's also what we call, from a mechanical perspective, has a stiffness that's on the same order of magnitude of the vagina. And so hopefully it's a little bit more compatible with the tissues in that space.
Structurally, how does it compare, especially in terms of implantation and functionally for the woman?
I mean, we don't really understand that. I mean, right now we're, you know, trying to come up with a polymer and that really is compatible. But that is our goal, is that structurally it would be similar to a woman who is non-parous, that meaning that she hasn't had a baby before and that her tissues are fairly strong and haven't incurred any damage yet. I just also wanted to add that one of the most important things that we were doing in the early age was examining the current materials that are on the market. And so there was lots of different products available. And what we were trying to do is define what is currently safe and effective from a mechanical and a biological standpoint that's more compatible with the host. And I think that you know, women who we implant with mesh should feel very safe because we really have come up with some products that are that overall the safety profile is really, really kind of favorable for them. We're just looking for to do even better than that.
What were your challenges in finding the right material for this?
The problem with a soft polymer is that they fail early, right? So we need something that's going to be strong enough to hold up when she's running or jumping or jogging, or a lot of women jump on trampolines with their children and that sort of thing. So the trick is to get something that's soft, so it's compatible with the material properties of the vagina, but at the same time, it's strong enough and tough enough so that it's not going to fail.
Did you have any materials in mind when you started out?
Yeah, we were very interested in looking at materials that were already FDA approved because we wanted to utilize something that could get to the market relatively quickly. Some of the materials that we first investigated, like Dr. Mowally said, is, you know, they provided the stiffness that we were interested in. So they were nice and soft, very similar to vaginal tissue. But as soon as we would test them, they would fail in what we call a very brittle fashion. So they were not nearly tough enough. And so that's what caused us to reexamine the types of materials that we're using and start collaborating actually with some folks at Duke University who've been helping us out tremendously.
You say they've been failing in tests. How do you test a device like this?
So we do perform basic mechanical testing. So we have machines that are in our laboratories that basically allow us to pull and push on materials. And we have essentially what's very similar to a scale in your bathroom that's attached to those machines. It's much more sensitive, but that allows us to measure the amount of force that we're applying to the materials. And so then essentially what we do is just pull those materials apart and see. We can extract all kinds of properties from that, but that's the typical test that we perform.
We've also, under Steve's leadership, have been able to develop computational models. So we can, from an MRI, make a 3D model of a woman's pelvis, and then we can apply a force to that and look how not only how new polymers, but new shapes will, you know, respond to different forces. We do in vivo studies as well using animal models when we have to, but this gives us insight well ahead of time of what may be successful and what may not.
So to clarify, this is not being tested on female patients yet?
Oh, no. We're many years from that.
So what is the next step then in the evolution of this challenge and potential solutions?
For the immediate challenge for our current product is to first of all, you know, finalize the polymer, and I think we're pretty close in determining that. But we also have to determine fiber width, the thickness of the material. So the beauty of our team is that in addition to the mechanical testing, we also look at the host immune response. We also have experts in collagen, you know, remodeling and elastin metabolism. So we're able to understand it from a very multifactorial perspective, and that hopefully this will lead to better outcomes for women.
It sounds like this has been an incredibly collaborative project over many years.
Yes. Yeah. I'm always thankful that Steve collaborated with me when he was very young.
I'm very thankful that she came to our laboratory. Indeed, there's been another key player in this is Dr. Katrina Knight, and this was actually part of when she was a graduate student with us. This was actually a major part of her graduate dissertation, and so she really did the lion's share of the work behind this and takes a lot of credit for why we are where we are.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we look very forward to the next step in your work. Dr. Pamela Mowally is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the McGee Women's Hospital and McGee Women's Research Institute. Dr. Steve Abramowicz is an associate professor of bioengineering at the University of Pittsburgh's Swanson School of Engineering. Thanks so much to you both for coming in.
Thank you very much.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Think summertime. Think live music. Think outdoors. Is anything more fun than that? Saturday is the annual Summer Music Festival by our sister station, 91.3 WYEP at Schenley Plaza in Oakland. WYEP's music director and midday host Kyle Smith is ready for the festival. Good morning, Kyle.
Hey, good morning, Kevin. Thanks for having me on.
So for those who haven't had the pleasure in the past, tell us a little bit about the festival. What's happening on Saturday?
Well, we do a big free event each summer, usually the final Saturday in June, and kind of kick off summer. It's a big thank you for to listeners in the community for and having folks out. Things get underway at 3 o'clock musically, and it's over Chandler Plaza in Oakland. It's right between the Hillman Library and the Carnegie Music Hall over there in Oakland. Big green space, lots of room, picnics, a market, and, of course, a lot of music.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the music. And a couple of the performers have special connections to WYEP, don't they?
Yeah, actually, for the last 6 years, we've been doing this project called Reimagination, and it's where we pair youth team musicians with area producers, and we produce a CD and have them go in and get some professional stuff going on. And so two of those will be opening up. We select two from the CD, and Elias Curry and also Pierce Dipner will be performing. They get underway at 3 o'clock.
And so Pierce, a little bluesy, would you say?
Yes, very much bluesy, and both of them kind of in the blues rock area. Elias Curry is really a guy that's just a phenomenal guitar player, too, at the age of 17. And I mean, like, really can tear it up. I saw a video of him beforehand, and I've seen him a couple of times now, and really impressive.
I hear that he has a couple of idols as far as the guitar.
Jimi Hendrix, definitely.
That's a good one to start.
One of them. Yeah, it sure is. And
Carlos Santana, I believe, as well.
Yeah, and the guy's impressive. So if you get there early, you can get a seat on the lawn and join us beginning at 3 o'clock.
Okay, those are the first two performers. Okay. Then we have Nevada Color.
Yeah, they've been around for a long time, and they have quite a following here in Pittsburgh. They've been around for about 10, 12 years and have a really great song out right now, and so they'll be taking the stage around 4:30. And Clara Kent is somebody I discovered back in February at a local showcase, and she is soul and R&B and rock and roll and has a fantastic band, and definitely one not to miss.
And Cautious Clay. And then the evening wraps up with the headliner, Dvochka. They haven't been here for a while, have they?
No, it's been about 7 years, and they did a sold-out show. And you may recognize that name. Dvochka had a song on the Little Miss Sunshine motion picture soundtrack quite a while ago, kind of propelled them to fame with that song. And they're an interesting band from Denver. They're a four-piece, and they have a theremin, a bouzouki, trumpets, and it's rock and roll as well, but it's a very eclectic mix of music. And they're a four-piece from Denver who actually got their start as an opening act for a burlesque band.
I wanted to ask you, a lot of local talent on Saturday. How important that is for a local radio station to highlight this local talent?
Well, it means everything to be able to spotlight and bring people to the stage and shine a star on some of the folks that may not always have the light shining on them. So they're going to be on the big stage, and we're pretty excited about that.
How does the music complement one each other?
There's rock and roll, there's blues, there's alternative rock with Nevada Color, and it kind of flows through the evening. And Cautious Clay is one not to miss as well, kind of soul and R&B and hip-hop.
Okay, and there's also a lot to do other than the music, although the music is the star.
There is. We've got a picnic contest going on. You can check out info on our website at wyep.org about that, and there's a market that'll be going on, and of course the artists will have stuff there, and in between sets, WYP DJs are going to be spinning some tunes as well.
And does that include you?
That will include me, yeah. I'll be there, of course. I'm pretty excited about it. And I think it's our 19th year of doing these.
Fantastic. Kyle Smith is 91.3 WYEP's music director, midday host. WYEP's annual Summer Music Festival is Saturday from 3 to 10 at Chandler Plaza in Oakland. Thanks, Kyle. Have fun.
Thank you very much. Hope to see you out.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, momentum is increasing in the state legislature for the Family Care Act to allow working Pennsylvanians to take leave to care for close family members without sacrificing their jobs. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.